Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. Dwight D. Eisenhower stands as one of the major figures of the 20th century. This man, brought up in small-town central Kansas, managed the Allied victory in Europe in World War II. Then, for 8 years in the 1950s, he managed the United States as president. Today, we'll learn how Eisenhower's early life prepared him to reach the pinnacle of two careers, one military and the other political. Our guest is Tim Reeves of the Dwight D. Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum in Abilene, Kansas. Tim Reeves, welcome to Central Standard Friday.
Thank you, Monroe. Good to be back.
Good to have you. Tim is the Deputy Director and Supervisory Archivist at the museum. Before that, he was, for more than 10 years, an archivist with the National Archives at Kansas City. He's a graduate of Wichita State and Emporia State. Tim, based on the persona that the public saw while Dwight Eisenhower was president, and on our memory of the Eisenhower era as a rather easygoing time in American life, this man can be easy to underestimate. But that's a mistake, isn't it?
It really is. And there was that stereotype that persisted for many years, at least from his presidential years, that he was this kind of avuncular, genial, do-nothing, golf-playing figurehead. And Eisenhower really, in a way, wanted to project that image. He wanted to project, you know, sort of a tranquility, I think, just as president, because the country had been through so much, from the Great Depression through World War II and then the Korean War. And so it was time for this sort of hiatus to that sort of drama, I guess you could say. So Ike did like projecting that image. But what the papers in Abilene at the Eisenhower Presidential Library have revealed, and which became available to scholars beginning in the early 1970s, was just how active Eisenhower was behind the scenes, and it really turned that stereotypical image of Eisenhower on its head.
Now, in the 1890s, this guy had not become a general, and he wasn't the president. He was just a boy growing up in Abilene, town of, what, 5,000-10,000 people?
Yeah, about 7,000. Yeah.
What kind of guy was he? If you'd run into him as a classmate in school, what would you have thought of this Eisenhower kid?
Well, he always had a reputation as being very smart, as being physically tough, of being a good athlete, being a very loyal and steady friend. Very, very popular kid.
And his mind tended toward the artistic, the outdoors, the active. What did his mind go?
Well, he did like the outdoors. In terms of his mind, very practical. Eisenhower was very good at math. He said it was his favorite subject because he liked the finality with which an answer was either right or wrong. He liked spelling in grammar school, he said, because it aroused his competitive instincts. And he was also intrigued, he said, by the way, changing a single letter in a word would change its meaning. Ike also loved history. In fact, spent a lot of time outside the classroom reading history, particularly ancient history, and that's where he discovered most of his heroes as a boy.
So much of our education happens outside the classroom, too. Here was Dwight Eisenhower. He was growing up in a rather large family and a rather poor family on the poor side of the tracks in Abilene.
That's right. The Eisenhower home, which is located, now encompassed by our campus in Abilene, is located south of the railroad tracks, with all that implies. Abilene, or Eisenhower, was considered to be from the wrong side of town. And he really began to realize this when he moved to Garfield Junior High, which was located at the north end of Abilene. And it was, you know, deep in enemy territory, as it were, and zealously protected by its natives. And Ike was really forced frequently to fight for the South Side's honor. And he talked about that in terms of being a lesson that it's that the pounding you get from an opponent is worse than the fear of anticipating the beating you may take from an adversary.
And so we're talking about out-and-out fistfights.
Out-and-out fistfights, you bet.
Going at it. Did he win?
He did. Yeah.
Quite the jock then. You studied a lot about what he studied in school and that part of his education. Tell us about that career and what that did to make him what he became.
In terms of his formal schooling? Mm-hmm. Yes. Again, math and history were always his favorite subjects. In fact, he was so good at math in high school that he was allowed to work without a textbook. He was so good in history that his high school yearbook predicted that he would someday be a professor of history at Yale. Now, his brother Edgar, who was actually a little older but had dropped out and came back to school, The yearbook predicted that Edgar would become president of the United States. They were off by one Eisenhower. Edgar instead went on to become a very successful attorney in Tacoma, Washington, and then a very sharp conservative critic of his little brother, the moderate Republican president. But Ike, Ike would always kind of downplay how good of a student he was. But he was an A and B student in high school. And then he was forced to take two competitive exams to get into West Point. He worked very hard preparing for those exams. West Point, he was a little indifferent academically when he first got there, and he eventually graduated 61st out of a class, 164. But he was ranked in the top 10 in English composition. In fact, went on to be considered the best writer in the War Department during his career. And again, he excelled at math. He devised new solutions to school calculus problems, that sort of thing.
In his public schooling in Abilene, there was a great winnowing out process in those days of kids from the first grade to high school, wasn't there?
Oh, there really was. In fact, in Ike's memoirs, he wrote that of the 200 children who began first grade when he did in 1896, only 67 went on to high school, and of those 67, only 31 graduated. And as he noted, that was the largest graduating class in the school's history. And to narrow that down even further, there were only 9 boys in that class of 31, and 2 of them were Eisenhower. So he really was, among the elite of Abilene's young people in terms of his education.
Now, in those days would be 1905, 6, 7, 8 for the high school time.
Yeah.
Kids weren't leaving town. They were simply dropping out to go to work.
That's right. And as Ike said, you'd learn to read and write and cipher, and then you were good for most jobs, at least that were available in a small town like Abilene at that time.
He was one of 7 children. 5 survived, I guess.
6 survived.
6 survived.
Yep, 6 out of 7.
And a father who was not a great teacher of him.
No, David Eisenhower was really kind of a distant and moody guy. Not a real strong a strong presence in the boy's life. But they did not have the kind of father-son relationship to where, David would have gone out and played catch with the boys after work. He would usually, he worked hard, come home from work, would have supper, and then preferred to read. And not a whole lot of interaction with his 6 boys.
Now, Eisenhower liked to camp. He liked to play sports. He liked to play poker.
He did like to play poker.
And he had an advisor who was someone other than his father.
There was this character named Bob Davis. And Bob Davis lived on his own somewhere outside of Abilene, was alleged to have made his living as a poacher and a trapper. He would use nets to fish, which was illegal at the time, and would catch catfish, which he would sell in town. He would trap muskrat and mink, that sort of thing. But he and Ike became friends. And Ike said from the age of 7 until he was 16, he spent many weekends with Bob Davis. And Bob Davis did teach him to hunt, to fish, to trap, and as you said, to play poker. Now, Davis was illiterate, apparently, but he was really good at ciphering percentages, and he would just drill percentages into Ike's head, Ike said, relentlessly. And so Ike really had this kind of early training in deducing probabilities, and Ike became so good at poker that he was eventually forced to give it up in the Army because he was winning so much money that it was causing ill feelings with his fellow officers. And so he switched to bridge, which he then played at a very high and competitive level.
So he learned statistics with the carrot out there of beating other guys at poker.
That's
taking
exactly
their money.
Right, yeah.
Obviously, that would serve too. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Munro Dodd. With us this morning is Tim Reeves of the Eisenhower Presidential Museum and Library in Abilene, Kansas. And we're talking about the 34th President, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Now, you have actually gone into some of the topics he studied in his public schooling in Abilene. What kind of things were being taught back at the turn of that century?
Well, it was a tough curriculum. Latin, German, English, Roman history. There were no electives. Well, I think there was an elective. I think your senior year you could take German instead of Latin. That's about as easy as it got. There was no underwater basket weaving in Abilene High School at that time. But again, it really prepared him well for admittance to West Point.
Speaking of West Point, had Eisenhower had a lifelong dream of being a warrior soldier, or how did that come about?
He enjoyed military history, particularly ancient accounts, when he was a boy. But it came about, he and Edgar, the brother who was most closest to him in age, wanted to go to college. The family didn't have the money for it. And so the plan was for Edgar to go to the University of Michigan for 2 years, during which time Ike would support Edgar, and then Edgar would drop out, and Ike would, you know, that was the plan. So it was really they were doing college on the installment plan, which wasn't ideal, but it was better than nothing. And so Eisenhower, Ike, to support Edgar, goes to work at the Bell Springs Creamery, which was an enterprise started by Ike's extended River Brethren family. And he's basically a boiler tender. And he works 84 hours a week from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. 7 days a week and makes something like $90 a month.
Wow.
But he gets in a conversation with a friend of his named Swede Hazlitt. And Swede tells him about his plan, which is to go to the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis. And so at that point, Ike gets interested in trying to get into one of the service academies. He finds out there's going to be a competitive exam administered by then Kansas Senator Joseph Bristow, and it kind of goes from there. He was concerned about his age. You know, Eisenhower had injured his knee, had gotten an infection in his knee when he was a freshman in high school, and almost cost him his leg, and missed his freshman year, so he was already older when he graduated. And he was actually getting ready to turn 20 in 1910, but in two letters to Senator Bristow, he said he was getting ready to turn 19, so he was cheating on his age a little bit. And indeed, he was too old for Annapolis, but West Point had a more liberal age policy, and so Ike got into West Point. But by the time Ike began his freshman year, he was almost 21 years old.
And that's why he was Army rather than Navy.
That's right. It was that simple. And it was really, it was to get a free college education and to play football if possible, which he did.
What did West Point in those days teach its young officers to be?
Well, I mean, it was a strictly military curriculum, mm-hmm. and heavy on engineering, heavy on, you know, the history of not just military history, but the history of battles. And I really disliked the way they taught it at West Point because it was just the rote memorization of commanders and where they were at, you know, a particular time in a battle. And it almost killed his boyhood love of history. But again, there were no electives at the time that Eisenhower was there. I don't think that came in until the 1920s under Douglas MacArthur, as a matter of fact, when he was superintendent. So it wasn't a typical liberal arts college education that I got.
Hardly even dabbling with it in the curriculum at West Point. And then he went on to the War College at Leavenworth, right?
He went to what was then called the Command and General Staff School, of course, now the college up at Leavenworth. And that was really, well, Ike called it the watershed in his life. He had spent the previous 3 years under the tutelage of General Fox Connor. Fox Connor had been the mastermind of American operations in World War I and was really kind of a military intellectual, really a deep thinker on, you know, the philosophy behind war, and was big in the humanities in terms of studying, you know, the histories of Shakespeare, that sort of thing. And he took Ike under his wing in Panama and really expanded Ike's horizons intellectually, and, you know, really forced Ike to think about military history, particularly in an analytical way, the way they didn't teach it at West Point. And I guess the point I've tried to make is that Fox Connor really prepared Ike well to go to Leavenworth, and in fact, he helped Ike get into Leavenworth 3 years ahead of schedule. But because of this time that Ike spent in Panama with Connor, he graduated first in his class at Leavenworth, class of 245. Also helpful were class notes that had been taken by a previous student, a friend of his named George Patton. That and a lot of study time helped Ike graduate first in his career.
So Fox
first
Connor,
in his class, I'm sorry.
First in his class. Fox Connor may have been the guy who took him beyond, who molded Eisenhower's mind beyond something beyond just a proficient military guy to someone who had a bit of a depth of understanding of life and human nature.
Exactly.
And other stuff, through reading. Did Eisenhower ever lead troops in battle?
Well, only at the highest level. He was not a combat commander, a tactical combat commander.
And he wasn't out there on the front.
He was not. Much to his, you know, disappointment. In many ways. Ike was such a good, really, administrator and trainer and manager and throughout his career that he never got the troop commands that he wanted. That was the big regret of his career at that time.
I believe he tried valiantly to get a troop command in World War I, and they wouldn't let him.
Well, that's right. And he was already, by that age, recognized for those organizational and managerial skills. He was promoted to the temporary rank of lieutenant colonel at a very young age, and at one point at Camp Colt, Pennsylvania, had 10,000 men under his command. Ike trained all-American tank corps soldiers in World War I. He was the first in his class to achieve the rank of lieutenant colonel, and he then received the Distinguished Service Medal for his efforts. But missing the war in France, the actual combat, was a huge disappointment. He thought it would ruin his career, and even told a friend he didn't know how he would ever explain it to his son, as if it were some kind of personal failing on his part. But again, just very early on, Ike was recognized for those managerial abilities that he had.
And that continued into the 1930s. He worked with Douglas MacArthur in the 1930s, basically in Washington, didn't he?
He did in Washington, beginning, it's not quite clear, officially in 33, but it looks like he may have started for him in early 32. Then he went with MacArthur to the Philippines, where they were tasked with building the Philippine Army, preparing it for that country's independence in 1946. And MacArthur basically left all the day-to-day work up to Ike. So Ike had this great experience in starting an army from scratch, you know, from having to lobby legislators for money and materiel, for developing an air corps to go along with the army. I mean, it really, when you consider then what he went on to do later in his career, it couldn't have been better training that he got in the Philippines.
MacArthur exists in retrospect as something of a caricature. This guy who defied Harry Truman and thought he himself was larger than life. What kind of lessons does a young military man who really wants to do well on the make learn from a Douglas MacArthur?
Well, there were positive lessons as well. Ike said he learned really how to manage people at a very high level, how to kind of macro manage rather than micromanage, how to instill loyalty in your staff, and also to give a subordinate an assignment and then get out of their way. MacArthur was really good at that, probably to a fault, and had very, very short office hours, you'd say, during the week. And again, Ike did, almost all the work. But I think there were negative lessons there as well. For one thing, it was just the whole dramatic atmosphere around Douglas MacArthur. In fact, Ike kind of famously said that he studied dramatics under MacArthur for 7 years. Very mercurial personality, but undoubtedly a military genius as well.
Yeah, he must have learned the failings of too big an ego.
Oh yeah,
by watching MacArthur. Now, all this time, he's not a single guy. It was fairly early on in his military life that he met the woman who was going to be his wife.
He did. I graduated from West Point in June 1915, went back, spent the summer in Abilene, and then went to Fort Sam Houston, Texas, in San Antonio. It's still there, and had only been there a few months when he met the daughter of this wealthy Denver, Colorado family named Mamie Geneva Dowd. And they had a fairly quick courtship, got engaged on Valentine's Day a few months after they met, and then married on July 1st, 1916.
It seemed like he met her at, as I recall it, at some party or some gala occasion where the families of local young marriageable women would take their local marriageable women.
Yeah, I guess there was quite a social scene. And also it was just kind of quaint Victorian age where you would actually go calling on people on Sunday afternoons.
Yeah.
And that's how Ike met Mamie. What's interesting is we know now from some letters that came to light not too long ago is that Ike was really on the rebound when he met Mamie. He'd had a very serious relationship with this young woman named Gladys Harding, whom he wanted to marry.
From Abilene.
And she rejected him. And this was just right up to the time that he first met Mamie. So it was a pretty quick turnaround.
How did the two work together? Did they have a formal relationship? Was it very close? Was it warm? How did...
It was close. Mamie, wealthy family. Her father became a millionaire when he was 40 in the late 19th century. And we're talking real money, $1 million in the 1890s. And so he basically retired and moved the family to Denver. And Mamie didn't have a lot of formal education. Mamie wasn't required to do much around the house. And so when Ike and Mamie married, not a whole lot of housework was getting done. Ike did a lot of the cooking. But they were very close in terms of just being, companions. The relationship is reported to have changed after the death of their first son. They had a son named Dowd Dwight Eisenhower, who was born in September of 1917. They called him Icky. You had Ike and Icky. Mm-hmm. Ike hired a maid, actually, to help Mamie with the housework when they lived at Fort Meade, Maryland, and the maid exposed Icky to scarlet fever. He caught it and died within a week.
And
as you can imagine, that did change their relationship. But as has been pointed out to me, neither Eisenhower's predecessor or successor shared a bed in the White House with his wife, but Ike and Mamie had the same bedroom during the presidential years. So that tells you something.
Yeah, it does. And do you have any idea how well they played off each other intellectually? Would he say, I need your advice or help me with this? Or is he the kind of guy that would do that? Did the era call for that?
That's a good question. My first hunch is that he did not. Mm. That probably he did not talk a whole lot of business with Mamie. Ike, I think, liked to have that sort of bright line between work and home. And he really liked to relax. Eisenhower was very social, liked to have. In fact, they would refer to the Eisenhower quarters wherever Ike lived around the world as Club Eisenhower. And it was a popular meeting place. Even during Prohibition days, Ike would make bathtub gin along with George Patton. Yeah. They would have bridge parties and dancing and singing. And so that's how Ike preferred to spend his off time.
And always there seemed to have been the golf.
The golf. And as a matter of fact, Ike took that up when he was in Kansas at the Command and General Staff School.
I played it in Panama, apparently. And, of course, he played it in the White House.
That's right. And he would even play during World War II, Telegraph Cottage, his little respite from London outside of town, was next to a golf course. And he would jump on the golf course and play a few holes when he could. But as president, he did play 800 rounds, which sounds like a lot over 8 years, and it was. But I guess one thing you could say in Ike's favor is that he did not play as much as Woodrow Wilson did when he was president.
Today there's a basketball court that's the centerpiece of activity at the White House, at least outside the office. Back then he had a putting green installed on the White House.
He did have a putting green installed, yeah. And that was, just to put it in a current context, that was, President Bush, of course, liked to run mm-hmm. and lift weights. President Obama, we know, likes to golf and play basketball. And that was just Ike's recreation, which, of course, a president desperately needs.
He picked it. It sort of attached to him, though, as a at least by his foes. It was sort of attached to him as a kind of intellectual laziness.
Yeah, the whole do-nothing stereotype that persisted for so long.
Well, we know he was an intelligent man, and we know he's an able man. And when we come back from our break, I'm thinking that we ought to talk a little bit more about what he was really like and what about that famous grin and what may have concealed. In fact, we'll be back after then to hear more about the 34th president and about the museum and library dedicated to Dwight Eisenhower's life and his military and political careers. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. We're talking with Tim Reeves, Deputy Director and Supervisory Archivist of the Dwight D. Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum in Abilene, Kansas. Next Thursday, Tim will speak at the National Archives at Kansas City about the education of the 34th president. The time will be 6:30 p.m. The archives building is just off Pershing Road and just west of Union Station. Right now, Tim is with us in the studio. You can join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or by emailing us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Tim, just before the break, we were talking about that famous Eisenhower grin and what it might have revealed or concealed. What kind of brain was going on inside that?
Well, that's a great question. As one of his aides said, it wasn't a friendly smile. It was a grin. And I think Eisenhower used it very strategically. And it did sort of camouflage a man who was very shrewd and intelligent, as we said, a very good poker player, very bright academically. And also it helped to, I think, conceal a man who, as his son John said in a recent interview, Well, John started to say he was talking to a historian and said, you know, my dad was about 50% sunny and congenial and 50% cold-blooded. And he paused for a moment and said, make that 75% cold-blooded.
Now, his career, Eisenhower's career leading up to World War II, when he gained his first early big fame, kept unfolding in this job and that job. In terms of his education, we're always learning all through our lives. What was happening in those years in the late 30s and early 1940s to educate him? What is he learning from then?
Well, kind of to back it up even a little farther, after World War I, and I think because of to make up for his disappointment of not going to France, Eisenhower volunteered for what was called the first transcontinental motor convoy of 1919. And this was, as I said, a convoy the Army put together. And they wanted to do a couple things. They wanted to really show off the Army's new fleet of vehicles, which the Army was newly mechanized, and also to demonstrate the need for a better national road system. And so Ike, looking for adventure, volunteered to go on the convoy, which went from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, California, a distance you can now cover in, what, 3 or 4 days if you push it. In 1919, it took 62 days. They only averaged 58 miles a day. But it was important. Ike learned a couple of things. One, it made him more familiar with his own country, going to many states and cities that he'd never had the opportunity to visit before. And it did make him, you know, a believer in having a better national road system. You couple that with his experience in Germany on the Autobahn following World War II, and Eisenhower then, of course, creates the interstate highway system when he's president, but you can directly trace that development back to his experience on the convoy.
Those were crude roads in those days, often, I guess, just following section lines and,
exactly,
and things, farm roads. And certainly the vehicles, though today we look back and say, oh, look at the classic 19-teens vehicles. They were very crude by today's standards.
Constant mechanical breakdowns and that sort of thing. So,
mm-hmm.
Oh, and another experience outside the classroom where Ike learned a lot was after Leavenworth. He was assigned to the American Battle Monuments Commission in Washington under General John J. Pershing, who, of course, had been the commander of U.S. forces in World War I and later Army Chief of Staff. The American Battle Monuments Commission's job is to take care of overseas American cemeteries, that sort of thing. And they were writing a guidebook to the American battlefields of Europe. There'd been a committee approach attempted of several officers trying to produce this book. Ike came in and by himself completed the work in 6 months, which didn't exactly endear him to his colleagues. General Pershing then decided he wanted the book revised, but he wanted Ike to go visit the battlefields of France first. And so Ike got the opportunity to study the battlefields that he'd missed during the war for a year. And ironically, even though he had missed the war, he probably became more familiar with that terrain than the officers who had actually served there, because, of course, they were, you know, had participated on a very narrow sector of the front. And so he got to see the battlefields he missed, and he got to familiarize himself with that terrain for World War II. So that was another very important experience.
In a lot of ways, the shaping of his mind, and maybe that's true of everyone, was as much due to luck and chance as it was to book learning.
And in fact, his friend George Patton referred to Ike because of his famous luck as Divine Destiny Eisenhower instead of Dwight David Eisenhower.
We have a caller, Dan from Independence. Good morning, Dan.
Hi, you guys. One of my favorite topics, I grew up in Topeka. I was born in 1948, so Eisenhower more or less seemed like a member of the family just because feelings about him were so good. Also, I kind of think that growing up in Topeka, when I finally read a piece by him that I wanted to mention and recommend to anybody who doesn't really know that much about Eisenhower, I think probably just living in Topeka and being that close to Abilene, the language was pretty close. But what really, I heard your guest comment about what a good writer he was, and I think this would be a good example of that too. It was something that he wrote for Reader's Digest, and it may have been published differently. It may have been a potboiler for his memoirs, but it's called Stories I Tell My Friends. And it's a brief bio that tells about his growing up in Abilene, what he did to get into the military academy, how hard he worked, and what it meant to him. just he touches on different things during his life, but including when he was in charge of troops during maneuvers, and some real humorous stories came out of it. So I just wanted to recommend that. And, of course, I live in Independence, Missouri now, and I've really read more about Truman than Eisenhower, but Eisenhower's a favorite. Great guy.
All right, Dan. Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
Right. There's actually the book Dan's referring to is At Ease, Stories I Tell to Friends. And Eisenhower wrote four books under his name, and I think it's his best. He wrote Crusade in Europe after World War II, then two volumes of his White House memoirs, and then At Ease. But he also wrote that Guide to American Battlefields for the War Department. For years in Washington, he wrote all the War Department's annual reports to Congress, wrote speeches for all of his superiors, wrote articles to be published under their name. And that's one of the things that's not very well known about Ike, is just what a fine writer he was.
And he impressed people along the way so that his career advanced to become the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe in World War II.
Everywhere he went. And it began very early after West Point of impressing his superiors. And a lot of it was not just his intelligence, but his work ethic. I mean, Ike would do anything it took to get the job done. And if that meant in the War Department years working from 7:30 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, he did it without complaint. And later in life, he expected his subordinates to do the same thing.
And the thing that enabled him to do this, I guess, was his demonstration of ability to manage.
That's right. And Ike was good with people. Ike was very gregarious and outgoing, kind of a natural leader. And people gravitated towards Ike. And again, that strategically used grin that he employed so famously helped as well.
In the last hour on NPR News, the StoryCorps had one about a man who had lost his son in Asia, in the fighting 10 days before it happened. It was sad. It was pretty much you listen to it and you'd choke up. Here's Dwight Eisenhower sending thousands and tens of thousands of people into battle and into death. How did he deal with that?
He was very aware of that. There's a famous speech he gives in June 1945 after the war called the Guildhall Address, where he's made an honorary citizen of London. And he talks about how humility must be what every man who earns his fame by I'm not phrasing it very well, but just the debt that Eisenhower owed to those who had made that ultimate sacrifice in the war, and how humble he was to be given this great honor for something that they did in making that sacrifice. He talked about it a lot in a 1964 documentary that he did with Walter Cronkite called D-Day Plus 20. And he was reminiscing how on June 6, 1944, his son John graduated from West Point. But that same day that all these other young men who had not had that opportunity were going, in some cases, to an almost certain death. And that how his son John then got to go on and have a life, to have a wife and children and a career. And how these other young men, it was, ended so prematurely. But he was very aware of that.
Now, after that, there was an interregnum when he was president of Columbia, I suppose. But he'd become this icon in American life. And I believe throughout the late 40s and early 50s, both the Democrats and the Republicans tried to get him to run for president.
They did. And what's interesting, and of course, 1941, Ike was an unknown, at least unknown outside the Army, lieutenant colonel. 14 months later, he was a lieutenant general in 1943 and was already being talked about as a presidential candidate. So it happened that quickly. We know that in 1945, when President Truman was in Berlin, actually for the Potsdam Conference, that he first suggested to Ike that he should run in 48. Then we know from both men's diaries, President Truman and Eisenhower, that on July 25th, 1947, there was a meeting in the Oval Office in which Harry Truman suggested to Ike that Ike take the top spot on the Democratic ticket in 48, and he'd be pleased to go back to the Senate. Ike turned it down. Among other things, Ike assumed that Harry Truman would lose in 1948. Then there'd be a Republican successor after serving two terms. Ike would then be too old, so he kind of put it out of his mind. And as you mentioned, he went on to Columbia University to be president. Well, then that fall, about 6 months after Ike's into the Columbia job, Harry Truman wins. And his most recent biographer, Eisenhower's most recent biographer, Gene Edward Smith, said at that point Ike really lost all interest in the Columbia job and started thinking more and more about the presidency. And there was kind of this popular, you know, groundswell of support for Ike to run as president that continued over the next 4 years. And to really make a long story short, by the spring of 1952, Eisenhower was willing to let his name be entered in the New Hampshire primary, and he had to declare a party at that point. And so he came out as a Republican, then, of course, retired from the Army on June 1st and went to Abilene on the 4th to announce his candidacy.
So that's the in a way, that's the KG politician playing reluctant but not really reluctant at all.
Exactly.
Ah. Yeah. And in that era, he represented a middle ground in the Republican Party, and he had his biggest opponent for the nomination was Robert Taft, who represented the right wing.
That's right. And in giving that quick little chronology, one thing I skipped is that President Truman appointed Ike to be the first Supreme Commander of NATO in 1951. Eisenhower was getting ready to issue kind of a Sherman-esque statement along the lines of, if nominated, I won't run, if elected, I won't serve. But first he wanted to get a guarantee from these Republican Party leaders that they would support the collective security arrangements of NATO. And if they did, particularly Robert Taft, although Ike doesn't name him in his memoirs, but that's who it was, if Taft would pledge to support NATO, Ike would issue that letter saying, I will never run for office. Ike had written that letter. He had the meeting with Taft. Taft would not give him that guarantee, and Ike said he destroyed the letter. And so from then on, in his mind, he was a viable candidate for the presidency.
That was an isolationist thing on the part of Taft.
That's right. That was from the more conservative isolationist wing of the party. And Ike was an internationalist. Ike basically supported the Democratic Party's foreign policy.
Now, we've just been through what I consider a rather drawn-out campaign for president that ended earlier this month. Americans today, in those days, 60 years ago, did not have to put up with quite as long a campaign, did they?
No. In fact, I laugh. I mean, it's funny when you look back at it now. Eisenhower went to the Republican convention in late July, got the nomination, and then immediately went on vacation. And then, while on vacation, decides he needs to hire a campaign manager. He hires his campaign manager in August.
Of
the year of the election. That's how different things are or were then, and decided to limit what he called his active campaigning to 8 weeks. And he went on a whistle-stop train tour of about 20,000 miles, and he did another 30,000 miles by air. He talked about those whistle-stop campaign appearances, and they were limited to 7 minutes. And he said his hope was always that there'd be at least 2 minutes of applause, so he wouldn't have to speak for the entire 7 minutes. But he would talk; he'd give his general campaign spiel, and he said he would have a card with two or three local issues on it. But they would make, you know, dozens of those stops in a day. But I thought that ideally a presidential campaign should be 30 days.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, here with Tim Reeves at the Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum in Abilene, Kansas. If you have a question for Tim or a comment about Dwight Eisenhower, you can call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Speaking of the campaign, in his two campaigns, 1952 and 1956, the nature of the American media changed vastly. You wouldn't have been assaulted by television commercials as much in 52 because you would not have had a television.
That's right. I've seen the numbers. In 1950, it was something like 6 million American households had televisions. By the end of Eisenhower's second term, 60 million, 85%. And that's how quickly it grew during the 50s. So Ike really was the first television president. And in fact, as you know, Ike won an Emmy for his television work. And Ike even had a television coach, an actor named Robert Montgomery. And for some of you who may be old enough to remember this, there was a television series in the late 1960s called Bewitched, starring Elizabeth Montgomery, and her father, Robert Montgomery, was Ike's television coach. But in terms of that 56 election, Eisenhower had a serious heart attack in September of 55. And then in the summer of 56, Ike had Crohn's disease. and had a major operation to correct the Crohn's disease in the summer of 56 and decided that he really wasn't going to do much campaigning. He said he would all do it all by mass communications. And so he did rely more on television appearances and that type of medium.
And the whistle stop campaign was done for.
Yeah, didn't whistle stop in 56.
Your mention of that in 1952, where he wanted the crowd's applause to fill the time because he only had a couple of local issues to talk about, differs so greatly from today when candidates stand up and they're programmed and behind them is usually stacks of the local product or some kind of scene or something. Then you pulled into town, stepped out to the back of the train, and took your chances with the audience.
A more innocent time.
Indeed, a little bit scary for the candidates, I could imagine. How did, in those days, one last question about elections, how did an electorate go about informing itself in those days?
Well, I think they paid a lot more attention to newspaper editorials. They paid a lot more attention to party leaders, to precinct committee men, that sort of thing. You know, yard signs used to actually have an influence. And, you know, how often do you see a yard sign anymore? Mm. The money's all spent on other types of media.
Certainly not for the national candidates as much. There has been some new information about Stephen Ambrose, the writer's biography of Dwight Eisenhower.
Well, that's true. And Ambrose, for years, had written what was considered the definitive two-volume life of Dwight Eisenhower that came out in the early 1980s. And his big claim to fame is that he had this unprecedented access to Ike, which, depending upon which interview you read, was anywhere from hundreds and hundreds of hours to 5 years to daily visits, that sort of thing. But we have the records of all of Ike's appointments from those years, and you can only document that Stephen Ambrose saw Dwight Eisenhower three times and that they were never even alone. And so that has taken a dig at his credibility the last few years.
That reminds me of the Merle Miller-Harry Truman controversy. How much did he really talk to him, and how much did Truman really say in plain speaking?
Exactly the same question.
Tom from Weatherby Lake emails us asking, we heard a bit about his father and that relationship. Can you talk about Ike's mother?
Ike's mother, Ida Eisenhower. The boys, the Eisenhower boys, worshipped Ida. In fact, Earl Eisenhower Jr., the son of Earl Eisenhower, Ike's brother, told me once that the brothers would actually, even as grown men, would almost come to blows arguing over who was their mother's favorite son. It's really interesting. David Eisenhower, Ike's father, dies in the spring of 1942. Ike at that time is the head of the War Plans Department in Washington and working, you know, 18, 20 hours a day in the early days of the war. So he can't go home to Abilene for the funeral. So he decides to take 30 minutes out of his day to think about his father. And he's writing in his diary about his father, but suddenly it's all about his mother, talking about his mother being the finest person he ever knew. And just clearly she was a much bigger influence in Ike's life than his father. And Ike physically resembles his mother as well.
And psychologists could have a field day with that family.
I imagine. But they are also successful. Here he had these six living boys from this very modest family. The oldest brother, Arthur, comes to Kansas City, lives in a boarding house with Harry Truman as a young man, works his way up through the ranks of Commerce Trust Bank to become a senior vice president. Mm-hmm. Edgar goes on to become, you know, a very successful attorney. Ike, of course. Roy goes on to become a successful pharmacy owner in Junction City, Kansas. Earl becomes an electrical engineer. And then Milton Eisenhower, of course, is famous in his own right, becomes president of Kansas State, Penn State, and Johns Hopkins University, as well as an advisor to every president from Coolidge to Richard Nixon.
Wow. Now, you work at the Eisenhower Presidential Library in Abilene. These days, 75-mile-an-hour speed limits, where you can move, you get there a little faster. How long does it take to drive?
From Kansas City, about 2 hours.
Okay, from Kansas City.
A little over 2 hours.
And
straight out
I-70. Okay. And if you haven't been there in a few years, what do you see now that you might have missed in the 90s or early part of this decade?
Well, the museum exhibits turn over regularly, and we have more and more temporary exhibits just to keep things fresh. Right now we have an exhibit, The Art of Shin He Chin. She's does fiber art and is doing this really great exhibit with different images of War and Peace. That will run through January 6th. Now we're really gearing up for the 70th anniversary of a lot of these major World War II exhibits. And those will begin in 2013 and actually go through 2016. So, you know, be on the watch for a lot of new World War II stuff at the Eisenhower Museum.
There, we're quite accustomed to going to the Truman Library here in Kansas City. It's as the caller said, it's a little more convenient for Independence. But it tells the story of Harry Truman and the presidency. The Eisenhower Museum, I think, does a good job of that, too, at least the last time I was there, of taking him all the way through his life, through the presidency. There's not only artifacts, but stuff that helps you understand the man.
There is. There's lots of images and, of course, facsimiles of documents and three-dimensional artifacts and just different anecdotes from Ike's life and Mamie's life and, you know, beginning with his boyhood in Abilene, of course, and going through his West Point and Army years and just all that vast range of experiences that Ike had leading up to the presidency.
What's your favorite part of the museum?
Oh, good question. You know, I really like Ike's post-presidential career.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in the old days, most presidents didn't live long enough to have a post-presidential career. Of course, now they're living 20 or 30 years. Ike lived not quite 10 years. But, you know, what do you do after you've been the most powerful man in the world? And to me, it's interesting to see how Ike and other former presidents, what they do with that time left in their life.
He retired to a farm at Gettysburg.
He did.
And he painted, right?
Ike began painting in his late 50s and, you know, became a great form of relaxation for him. And he really improved. You can see the improvement in his paintings over the years. But he would copy other artists, Andrew Wyeth, or he'd take a famous photograph and paint his version of it.
Well, I think that'd be excusable, having spent your entire career doing something else. He's been in the news lately, at least his name has been. There's a proposed monument in Washington, D.C., done by the famous architect Frank Gehry, that the family has opposed. What can you tell us about that, and have you come into the middle of all of that?
Well, we have a little bit. The Eisenhower Presidential Library Museum is not officially associated with the Eisenhower Memorial Commission, although we do support them in terms of providing information, historical information, for what they're attempting to do. Frank Gehry, as you said, the world-famous architect, presented his design to the commission almost 2.5 years ago, and it was approved by the board, which, you know, did include some family members. However, they have recently decided they don't like some aspects of his design. I think in some ways they think maybe it's a little too grand for Eisenhower, that he would not have wanted that sort of monument to himself. And so there has been a great deal of negotiation on trying to change that design. And I honestly don't know where it stands right now. I'm hopeful that there will still be some kind of Eisenhower Memorial up in Washington at the end of this. But at this point, it's hard to say exactly what form it's going to take.
That's what I recall reading the story about it. John Eisenhower, his son, saying it was all just a bit too much.
Mm-hmm.
That in fact, a lot of the things represented there could be better told in a museum. And I immediately thought of the Abilene.
Yeah, well, here we are. Yeah. And Eisenhower apparently at one time in France said he saw, you know, a big statue of Napoleon that literally made him sick. He just did not like that kind of grandiose memorialization of, you know, historic figures. In fact, you know, we have a good-sized, as you know, great Eisenhower statue at the center of our campus. Mm-hmm. It was put up in the 1980s by Harry Darby, Kansas City and big supporter of Ike's. Eisenhower probably wouldn't have even liked that much of a monument to himself. You know, he just had that good old-fashioned Midwestern modesty that just was kind of turned off by that sort of thing.
I guess you couldn't call him a humble man, but he certainly realized what was overboard, I guess,
I think that's fair to say, yeah.
We were talking about Douglas MacArthur and ego a while back. Obviously, Eisenhower had a big ego, but
he did, but again, I think it's more of that kind of cultural modesty that seems to be bred out here in this part of the country where, you know, you just don't promote yourself like that.
Now, you're going to be speaking next Thursday night.
That's
about
right.
His education, mm-hmm. and some of those kind of things. That'll be at the National Archives, which, if people haven't checked in recent years, has moved from out on Bannister Road down to the Union Station complex.
That's right.
And you'll be speaking at 6:30
mm-hmm.
about the education of Dwight Eisenhower.
I will.
And what have you not told us today that you're going to mention that night?
Oh, my gosh. We've covered an awful lot of it. But maybe I'll just save what I haven't covered as a surprise for those who do attend. How's that?
Eisenhower, you admire in his retirement, or at least you're fascinated by his retirement. Mm-hmm. Eisenhower as a child. These are eras we don't think much about. They weren't in the public view. But he certainly seems to loom as a major American figure. And actually, from what seemed to be a fairly open and easily understood man, a far, far more complex character.
Yeah, the closer you get, the more complex Ike seems to get.
Hmm.
And another thing about that post-presidential period, not only Eisenhower did, but all former presidents do, is they're trying to manage their legacy and their reputation. And Ike certainly had a lot of repair to do to his reputation coming out of the presidency, and I think he was very successful in a lot of ways at repairing that damage.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. We've been talking with Tim Reeves, the Deputy Director and Supervisory Archivist at the Dwight D. Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum in Abilene. Next week, Thursday night, Tim will be in Kansas City for a presentation about the education of Dwight D. Eisenhower. That'll be at 6:30 p.m. at the National Archives near Union Station. Tim, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
It was indeed a pleasure. And our show is produced today by Matthew Long Middleton and Danny Alexander. Our announcer is Kim Noble. You can go to kcur.org for complete Central Standard Friday archiving program, podcasts, and more. I'm Monroe Dodd. Tune into Central Standard Friday next week for the food critics as they troll for the best fish in Kansas City. This is Central Standard Friday, and enjoy your day.